Hope you are. I want to tell you a story this morning. It's one I'm absolutely, well, I shouldn't say that with certainty. I found out that sometimes I'm mistaken, but I'm pretty sure that most of you, if not all of you, have heard this story before, but humor me anyway, okay? I'm not going to tell you the guy's name, but within the first few sentences, you should have it figured out. And if I gave you the scripture reference, you'd have it figured out right away. It's a sad story, but it's a story of triumph in the end. There was a guy who loved God greatly. He was also very rich. He wasn't only rich with land and animals and other wealth, but he was rich in his family life. He had a great family. We would call him blessed, like we talked about earlier. One day, Satan decided that he's going to have a meeting with God. And God said, "What have you been up to?" "Oh, you know me. Wandering around, checking things out, seeing what trouble I can stir up." God couldn't help but ask him and said, "Hey, have you noticed that man that I love and he loves me? Have you paid attention to him?" And Satan says, "Well, yeah, of course he loves you. Look what all you give him. I mean, good night. If you take some of them things away, he's not going to love you anymore." And God, of course, wants to prove Satan wrong, so he relents and he says to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on his person." And Satan's like, "What? Who, me? I wouldn't do such a thing." And he walks away laughing. Okay, I'm paraphrasing. I'm assuming this is how it went. And this is where the firestorm hits this man of God. All of his 7 sons and 3 daughters were having some sort of a banquet in their oldest brother's homes. And this man was rejoicing because his family was getting along and he was so blessed to have family that loved each other. And as he was considering his blessings, a servant came running in. "Master, master," the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them when the Sabaeans raided them and took them away. "Indeed, they have killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." And he's just, "Whoa, that's sad. Wow, what a loss." And he took a moment, okay, breathe. "Okay, yes, I lost 1,000 cows and 500 donkeys, and sadly some of my servants too, but my family's okay." But he barely had time to think about that when another servant came rushing in with more bad news. "Master, master, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." And he's like, "Whoa, what's happening here?" Okay, so 3,000 sheep and more servants. "But my family's okay, thank you, God." And they say bad news comes in threes. I'm not sure who came up with that. I don't agree with it because I have found it to be more than 3. But he barely had time to process this last loss until another servant came busting in with more news that was less than pleasant. "Master, I hate to tell you this, but the Chaldeans formed 3 bands, raided the camels, took them away, yes, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." Wow, okay, this is great, he's thinking. "I've lost all my animals. Everything's gone. This last blow of 3,000 camels and yet even more servants. What more can a fellow take? But I am so glad my family's okay." But then the last servant comes running in with bad news, the worst news of them all. "Master, I can hardly bear to tell you this. Your sons and daughters are eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and suddenly a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the 4 corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they are dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you." This man that Satan decided to use in this horrible test stood up, ripped his clothes, shaved his head, and what did he say? Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Scripture states, and in all this time, he did not blame God. Well, you'd think that would be the end of the story. You'd think that was enough for one person to handle. And Satan would surely be convinced that this dedicated man of God, his response was good enough. But he wasn't. So he met with God again, and God says, same conversation. Where have you been? Oh, you know me, running around, seeing what trouble I can stir up. Did you see how my servant stayed dedicated to me, even though you tried to defeat him? Well, of course he would. You didn't touch him. You didn't let me touch him. I mean, if you do something personal to him, he's going to turn against you. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life. And Satan's like, what? I wouldn't even think of such a thing. And he cackles as he walks away. And what did Satan do to this man of God? He caused him to be covered with some kind of boil. They were painful. They were open. They were oozing. Head to toe. Scholars believe it was leprosy. Some believe it was a form of smallpox. Either way, it was awful. And he used a piece of broken pottery to scrape himself. And he sat in ashes. Two purposes, I think. One, when in Bible times when someone was in mourning, they sat in ashes. But I also can't help but think the ashes, they're dusty, help dry up their sores. Just my thought. I'm not saying that's accurate. But either way, he was a miserable man. Well, I feel like most of you know that we're talking about Job here. And while I'm continuing, would you please turn to the book of Job? And I'll give you the reference. It is only one verse, but I want you to look at it while I'm reading it. And I hope I don't come across as insensitive and act like none of our problems are as big as Job's. But I'm pretty sure that none of us can say we've been through that level of trauma, especially not in that short of a period of time. Because we're talking moments after another. But I also know I'm speaking to a group of people that have gone through some pretty heavy things. And I've watched God's grace pull you through. I don't want to say that Job had it worse and make it seem like I'm minimizing what anyone goes through. But what I want to learn is how did Job handle all this and how did he grow through it? Our story isn't done. Job had some wonderful supporters through this trouble, and notice the sarcasm. The first great support was his wife. Listen to what she said in Job 2:9, and you don't need to turn to this, I'm just reading some of this. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. I said, well, thanks for that, dear. That was helpful. Encouraging. What a helpmeet God gave me. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God? And shall we not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Job's commitment and dedication to following God was amazing. And even though he was walking through intensity that no human being should ever have to walk through, he never blamed God. And I'm just going to pause for a minute and say this. That I am convinced, and if I'm wrong, feel free to come tell me, but I am convinced that every one of us, at one point, has blamed God for something, or at the very least, we've questioned God, why are you doing this, and why are you allowing this to happen? And rest assured, I'm not saying that's wrong. In fact, I go as far to say that I think you should, because if you're thinking it, talk to God about it. He wants to know. He wants you to speak to him. He already knows what's there. So go ahead and talk to him about it. But what is amazing in this story is that Job didn't even question. He had crazy grace and strength from God that we don't know about because we didn't go through what he went through. But I know some of you have come pretty close. And here's where the story of Job and his support system gets really touching. And again, notice the sarcasm. Job had three friends that decided to come and comfort him. We refer to them as Job's comforters. And we always use them as sarcasm, like, oh, there's some of Job's comforters. You know, someone that's not supporting you. We'll call them a Job's comforter. These guys were Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. Apparently, when they were being born and named, their mothers were sneezing or coughing or something, because there's no other explanation about why they got the names they got. But it is evident that they had sympathy for Job when they got there. We often miss this portion. It says, and when they raised their eyes from afar and did not recognize him, they lifted their voices and wept, and each one tore his robe and sprinkled dust on his head towards heaven. So they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights. And no one spoke a word to him, for they saw his grief was very great. Now, we quickly focus on what they did to blast him, and yeah, I get that. But how many of you have ever had a friend come and sit with you for 7 days and seven nights and not say a word, just be there for you? How many times have you done that for someone else? For the entirety of chapter 3, Job states he wished he'd never been born. And before we get all judgmental and say, well, he's blaming God now. No, he wasn't. He was just sharing what was on his heart. It'd have been better if I wasn't born, then I wouldn't have to deal with all this. Apparently, Job's three friends didn't feel as gracious towards him, because for the next 28 chapters, and don't worry, we're not going to read all of them, there was nothing but wisdom from Job's friends, which Job obviously felt like they were slams, because each nugget of wisdom that was like a chapter long he shared, then they have another chapter response that Job shared in response to that. And while we're not going to study all of their comments and his responses, what I will say is there is a lot of truth to be gleaned through there. But what I want to point out is, when you have a friend that's going through a hard time, a family member, be there for them. They aren't looking for answers. And I really don't think Job was looking for answers either, even though his friends thought that he needed to hear them. Be there for your friend. Show them that you care. Show that you love them, and you don't need to fix whatever they're going through. Just be there to support them. And it was in the middle of these friends' discourses that we find a response from Job, where we get this nugget of truth for today. It's a very popular verse, and we actually use it quite often. It's Job 23, verse 10. And if you would find that, please. And this is still in the middle of Job's, their back and forth. Job's comforters telling him things that he needs to fix, and Job's response. And this is in the middle of one of those responses. Job says in 23 verse 10, but he knows the way that I take. When he has tested me, I shall come forth as gold. I want to break this into three parts. And let's just hang on to this verse and check it out as we go through, and or maybe you have it memorized. I mean, honestly, it's a very popular verse. Let's see what Job can teach us about going through trials. First, he knows the way I take. Do you know God knows where you are at? He knows all that you're going through, and he understands you really better than you understand yourself. David put it really well. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know my sitting down and my rising up. You understand my thought afar off. You comprehend my path and my lying down, and are acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word on my tongue, but behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. You have hedged me behind and before and laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it. Where can I go from your spirit, or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend into heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there shall your hand lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. All the bitter, weary days, or ways, sorry, endless striving day by day. You barely have the strength to pray. in the valley low. And how hard your fight has been, how deep the pain has within, wounds that no one else has seen, hurts too much to show. All the doubt you're standing in between, and all the weight that brings you to your knees. We may faint and we may sink, feel the pain and near the brink, but the dark begins to shrink when you find the one who knows. The chains of doubt that held you in between, one by one, are starting to break free. He knows. Every time that you feel forsaken, every time you feel alone, he is near to the brokenhearted. He knows. Every hurt and every sting, he has walked the suffering. He knows. Let your burden come undone. Lift your eyes up to the one who knows. I'm not going to stand up here and say, I know what you're dealing with and I understand, because everyone deals with something and everyone's problem's different. But I can tell you, I do know the one who knows. The next phrase is, when he has tested me. One of the most common questions I've heard asked relating to people in suffering is, does Jesus or does God punish people by giving them hard times? I'm not one to say that God brings punishment, and that isn't to say he doesn't. But like I said earlier, when someone's going through a tough time, they don't want answers. They need support. One thing that really bothers me is when someone is going through something difficult and another person says, well, God's trying to get their attention. I heard it said many times after 9/11 that God was punishing America. I don't really care what your opinion is on what I just said, and hear me out. But what does matter is that when someone is going through a tough time, those kind of statements don't help. In this story, God was fully aware of the situation Job was in, and he gave permission to Satan to inflict all those problems on Job. He really did put Job to a test in this situation. Is that to say that every trial we go through is a test from God? No, I truly don't believe it is. But every trial we go through can test to see if we will stay faithful to God. I'll explain it to you this way. Many people question that if God truly is in control, why does he let bad things happen? If God is a God of love, why does he let bad things happen? Well, God is in control. He made everything and he keeps everything operating. And we see that in nature and the stars and the solar system and all that. But there's one big caveat. He gave humankind a free will to do and to choose what they want. He didn't create robots. So therefore, while God is in control, he is not a controlling God. He doesn't control what you and I do. Be a lot easier if he would, don't you think? But no, that's not how God operates. If someone wants to go out and get drunk and drive that way, he's not going to stop them. That's a decision they'll make. And unfortunately, innocent people pay for that decision many times. If someone wants to take a gun and shoot up a place, God's not going to stop them. That's their decision to make. And innocent people will be hurt in the process. Sometimes people deal with problems that they brought on themselves from poor life choices. But setting even all that aside, we need to recognize that we live in a fallen world and people have problems. We're broken. It all stems back to the fact that one guy chose to disobey God. The first man and woman chose to disobey God, and because of their choice of disobedience, everybody in life now is cursed with a broken world. So we all have to face hard times because God gave man a free will, and he chose to disobey. And while God may or may not bring challenges in our lives, this I can say for certain. He will use them if we let him. And he will use them to make us better if we let him do that. Just like in school, you know, you have to learn and you have to study and then you have to take a test to see how much you actually know. So in our Christian lives, as we're growing, sometimes we're faced with a test to see if we're going to stand up to the trouble and trust God through it. How much commitment do we have to God? Are we going to walk away when times get tough? Or are we going to stay faithful? Are we willing to grow when we have a tough time? Move on to the next phrase and the last one. I shall come forth as gold. Apparently, Job was pretty familiar with the refining process of precious metals. In chapter 28, he makes some references to that. It could have been because he was a wealthy man, and that's, you know, wealthy people had to learn how to work with that stuff. I don't know. Maybe it was just common knowledge back then. Refining with flame is one of the oldest methods of refining gold. And I actually found out that refining gold now is done with chemicals, not with heat. It is sometimes. In ancient times, this form of refining involved a craftsman sitting next to a hot fire with molten gold in a crucible being stirred and skimmed to remove the impurities or dross that rose to the top of the molten metal. With flames reaching temperatures in excess of 1,000 degrees Celsius, which is 1832 Fahrenheit. That's pretty warm. This job was definitely a dangerous occupation for a gold refiner. When Job was explaining the intensity of his trials and saying that they were comparable to the intensity of the flames required to refine gold. When the heat in gold refinery gets up to the right temperature, the flaws and imperfections in the gold just kind of float to the top, and you can just scrape them off. Job knew that if he allowed God to work in his life, he would come out better on the other side because God skimmed off those imperfections out of his life. There's a saying that's been around for a while, and I'm not getting exactly right, but you can choose to let a problem make you bitter, or you can let it make you better. And there's also, I believe it's a song, pretty sure it is, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And some of those might be trite, but they're very true. You tell me if you have ever grown during good times. Stop and think about it. I don't think we do. When things are going good and we have all the money to pay all the bills and we feel great physically, are we growing spiritually? Probably not, because we're enjoying life. But when faced with adversity, we soon learn how to adapt and grow through them. As Christians, and that's just in life in general, but then as Christians, we learn through our trials that God is there. And he has enough grace to get us through. And just like the impurities rise to the top and when gold's being melted, so our areas of immaturity and weakness, they can rise to the top, so to speak, under test, and God can deal with them if we let him do that. And I'll tell you, for one of the things I've learned from my trials and I've experienced in my life, I have learned that I need to be supportive and sympathetic when someone else is going through a trial, even when I don't think it's that bad of a trial. Because I know what it feels like to have people support me, even if they don't think my problem's that big. I want people to know I care about them, because I like to know people care about me. And I also tell you this. I've watched some of you go through trials, some dark times, and I've watched you grow through them. I don't want to single anyone out and say any names. I could, but I've watched you, and I've seen it. And I've also learned a lot from you, especially some of you, and again, I won't mention any names, but I've watched you, and you've taught me a lot about faith in God through tough times. And I look back at you right now, and like I said before, as I've been here long enough, now I know what you're going through. Doesn't mean I understand it, but I do know what you're going through. And I know some of you are walking through the fire. Remember, we have a choice. We can get mad at God and walk away and say, he's pathetic and he's not helping me. Or you can allow him to help you grow through it, strengthen you, and walk close to him through it. And you'll come out the other side a stronger Christian. I can assure you that. But what happened to Job? Turn to the back of the book, chapter 42. What was the end of Job's story? And if any of you are mathematicians, and I know there's several out here, you can do the quick math from what he lost to what he has now. God did a good job of doubling that. Job 42:12. Now the Lord blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning, for he had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 female donkeys. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that's exactly double. He also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. And in all the land were found no women so beautiful as the daughters of Job, and their father gave them an inheritance among their brothers. After this, Job lived 140 years and saw his children and grandchildren for 4 generations. Now, I'd say that's a good ending to a really sad story. What's the end of your what's the end of your life going to look like? I just assume you not end it right now, like let's keep living it. But what I'm saying, what's your story going to look like? How's the ending going to be? We don't know. But are you going to allow God to write that story and refine you? It's not a trite question. And even now I struggle with that. It's like, Lord, what are you doing? But let's trust him to write the story the way he knows is best. And then we'll come out refined as gold. Stand with me, please.